Hey everyone, and welcome back to Crime Ghoul, a true crime podcast where I'm your host, Brittany, and I bring you all things true crime. So if you've been following me on social media or you tuned in for last week's episode about the Girl Scout murders of Oklahoma, you will know that in the month of November, I am covering notorious cases. So this week, I decided to go with a very popular missing persons case. It's internationally known, and this is going to be the case of Maura Murray. You probably have heard of this if you're a huge true crime fan, but if not, I'm happy to be the first person telling you about it. So we're going to jump right into it because there is a whole lot to cover, so follow closely. Don't get too lost. It is a very windy road, I'll tell you that. So go brew yourself a cup of coffee, pour yourself a glass of wine, or perhaps take a shot of whiskey, because as always, these true crime cases are not for the faint of heart. Thank you so much for listening. So if you guys are familiar with the case of Maura Murray, you will know how many turns this case takes. It's crazy. So I wasn't kidding when I said follow along closely. We're going down a dark road, turn your flashlights on, make them super bright, and don't get left behind because this case can get very confusing very quickly. So many people have covered this case over the years, and there are so many different theories and speculation that come out, but mainly I'm going to focus on the facts today. We might do a little theory exploring. I'm not going to go too in-depth because I want to stay true to what the facts are of this case and not get too lost, because it's already easy to get lost with just the facts. So we're going to go over it, and we're going to kind of break it apart piece by piece as best as we can. It is super easy to get overwhelmed by this case. Missing person cases could drive someone mad, like absolutely mad, and welcome to the rabbit hole. Sorry I brought you here, but once you learn about this case, it's impossible not to become infatuated with it and consumed by it. So this case is a doozy, and it's one of the most notorious missing person cases, as I've said. So this is legitimate a vortex. It is like a rabbit hole, a wormhole, whatever you want to call it. There are so many different ways that this case could go. So I want you to think about your loved ones and what it would be like to lose one of them and to never know what happened to them or where they went, how they went missing, how they poofed, how they vanished off the face of the earth, and what lengths would you go to for answers. In February of 2004, the Maura family would be thrown into a legitimate nightmare. On February 9, 2004, a 21-year-old college student got into a car accident miles and miles away from her university. Within a 7-minute period of time, she would seem to vanish, disappear, or just like blip off the face of our planet, like gone in the night, literally. And her name is Maura Murray. Before we can get to the date and time she vanished, we have to rewind a little bit, and I have to tell you about Maura and what her life had been like before she had disappeared. Experts say that disappearances can be solved by looking for hidden actions or hidden clues in words in the day before the missing person vanished. So Maura's last known whereabouts may hold the clues necessary to finding her, and retelling her story is the key to getting answers. And not allowing people to forget about Maura is what's super important to finding her. So I'm going to jump right in and break down Maura's life in a very short, summarized, concise kind of way. But I want you to bear with me because I've done a lot of research on this case. I've listened to a lot of YouTubers, podcasters, more importantly, more professional resources as well, like Oxygen, Investigation Discovery. And I mainly honed into the episodes that really contained interviews with the family and witnesses. There are so many armchair detectives and web sleuths, and I kind of fall into the category myself. And it could be an amazing thing, but it can also be very hurtful to a case when people start throwing around speculation, incorrect times, and, you know, God knows what else. But sometimes it's like a game of telephone where all of the information gets a little lost in translation or things are a little contorted. And even with the Murray family themselves, you know, they hold true to whatever time frame they have, but things can be recalled incorrectly and it can be really hard to remember everything. So I'm going to go based off of these professional sources and the family, and we're going to try to look at these times and dates. If you've listened to other podcasts or YouTubers, you might notice some differences with the time. Well, definitely not differences with the dates, but times. Time is where it gets a little fuzzy and it could be a little murky. So I just want to make it clear that I'm sticking to the time frame that the family has talked about and that some concrete records follow. So like phone logs, police reports, we're going by those time frames. So first and foremost, who was Maura Murray? Well, she was a beautiful girl with brunette hair, hazel eyes, and she loved sports and athletics from the time of childhood into her young adulthood. She was a polite, kind, funny, well-rounded person, but she wasn't perfect by any means. Most of us aren't. There are actually some questionable actions from Maura's past that we're going to get into, but all in all, her family wants you to remember that she was a goofball. She loved her family time. She was always cracking jokes. She was known for being hysterically funny. She liked to make jokes about her family, even herself, and she loved her friends. Like the people she was very close to, she was very loyal to, loved them, and loved life. She enjoyed the outdoors. She enjoyed hiking. And that was really more in a nutshell. She was also extremely intelligent, very book smart. So Maura was one of four kids. There was Kathleen, Julie, Maura, and Curtis. And her parents' names were Fred and Lori. Maura and her siblings were raised as Irish Catholics, and they were born in Hanson, Massachusetts, and that's where they lived for the majority of their lives. Maura's parents would divorce when she was just 6 years old. Maura and her siblings would end up living with their mother full-time, but Fred was still very involved in their lives. Maura and Fred were extremely close. Besides being her father, Fred was her best friend and her sports coach. Fred was heavily involved with all of the kids, but he and Maura seemed to have a lot in common. They loved hiking, mountain climbing, running, and of course, sports. Maura was close to all of her siblings, but more so with her sister Julie. Julie was also athletic and competitive, just like Maura, and they were actually on some of the same sports teams while going through their school academic careers, and they loved it that way. They would even attend the same university after high school, and this would be for a short amount of time, but nonetheless, they did attend uni or university together at the same time. Maura was always an honor student, and when attending university, she was on the dean's list. She was a star athlete from the time of high school, and she continued that into college. She loved basketball, track, and cross country. In 2001, Maura met her boyfriend Billy Roche, and they had been dating until her disappearance. Maura attended the prestigious military school of West Point after graduating from high school. She had been scouted for the school due to her running capabilities and her excellent grades. She majored in chemical engineering, and her sister Julie had already been attending West Point, so this was a perfect fit for Maura. Maura and Billy loved each other very much, but their relationship was not absent of hardship. By the end of 2003, Maura would end up transferring to the University of Massachusetts. You see, Maura got herself into some trouble, and while she was attending West Point, they went on a school trip to Fort Knox, and she actually stole a bottle of nail polish and lipstick from a commissary store. She was caught and received disciplinary actions, but this was not Maura's first disciplinary action. She actually had 7 infractions at West Point by the time she was caught for her theft. So it's kind of unclear as to what happened, what those 7 infractions were, but clearly Maura seemed to be a great athlete, and educationally, academically, she was doing great, had wonderful grades, but there was a side of her that was a little troublesome, or I don't know if you want to say troublemaker, but there was something, you know, kind of not right there. Someone who seems like the perfect student, but had 7 infractions, like behaviorally. So that's interesting to note. I don't know too much about that. I wish I did, honestly. But her family doesn't really talk about this time in her life, like the infractions, the theft, and we're going to get on to some more behavioral discrepancies as we move forward with the story. But the family doesn't touch too much upon this. I mean, I guess they don't think it's as important to her case. They really just think that she went missing. And then there's other people who weigh in and say, of course, everything's important. Her whole entire life and up until the point that she goes missing is important. And I tend to agree with that because I think it is part of who Maura was. You know, we all have these negative aspects of our personalities. They're there. You know, even the nicest person, the most wonderful person in your life, there's something negative about them. It's just about balance in life, and that's how it is. Human beings are not all one thing, like all good or all bad. Inherently, there's usually some discrepancies, and if we didn't have those discrepancies, like, I don't know that we would necessarily be human. So once Maura was caught for the theft, obviously she had these 7 infractions under her belt, she was actually about to get kicked out of West Point. And if she got kicked out, of course that would be on her record. So before this could happen, she decided to withdraw from West Point. So, you know, this wouldn't permanently leave a mark on her. So her friends were shocked. Her family was shocked. Stealing items, stealing from a store, especially in Fort Knox, was extremely out of character for Maura. She herself did not know why she stole the items because she did have money with her. She had the money to purchase the items, and for some reason she just didn't. So, you know, I guess a lot of us go through that period of time where we maybe steal something from a store, whether it's something small or something a little bit bigger. Obviously, this tends to happen in like our juvenile adolescent years, young adolescents. Usually by the time we get to college, like that has stopped. And if it hasn't, you know, we get kind of worried there. Like, or if as a child, like a juvenile young adolescent, if it's like really bad and it's very, very expensive items, of course, that would tend to make us believe or wonder if that person has conduct disorder, if they have like, you know, a problem stealing. Or was more like a kleptomaniac where she liked, you know, stealing things. She kind of had an impulse to do it and she got like a rush from it. We're not sure, but you could be the judge of that. I mean, I'm not expert enough on Maura Murray to make that claim, but it's just a thought. So needless to say, Maura applied to the University of Massachusetts, or UMass, and she decided to major in nursing, which was clearly very different from chemical engineering at a military school like West Point. So going from New York to Massachusetts. So after a little while of Maura attending UMass, some problems would arise. So Maura, like I said, was a nursing student now. So she was enrolled full-time as a nursing student. She was still, you know, engaging in sports. She had 2 part-time jobs. She was a security, or acted as security, in one of the dormitory halls and an art gallery. And on top of this, she had to do clinicals. And clinicals were off campus and they were pretty far away, so a car was needed. So as you can tell, Maura was a very busy person. In November of 2003, so the end of that year, the end of 2003, before the new year, Maura was caught engaging in credit card theft. So it would turn out that she stole a credit card account number from a receipt. The receipt belonged to one of like the roommates or someone who lived in the dorm that she was living in. She had found the receipt somewhere, and back then, account numbers were still like fully logged on a receipt, which is just crazy to think about. So I can't even imagine that. There would be so much credit card fraud now, I'm sure, if that was still the case. So basically, Maura had been ordering food from local pizza places, specifically Di Pinocchio's Pizza. Some people say she also ordered from Domino's, all that stuff. And it was over the course of some time. It wasn't all like just in one go. But she was ordering a significant amount of food from these places, like pizza, Heroes, whatever, what have you. And it was obviously more food than she could consume on her own. And so many people have a difficulty understanding like why. And I'm sure her family knows, but again, they don't really like focus too much on this in their interviews. They do acknowledge it like briefly, but they don't go into details, which I totally understand because, you know, it's Maura's life. We all make stupid decisions and it's embarrassing at the end of the day. That was really Maura's personal business and poor decision making on her end. But nonetheless, the woman whose account number was stolen, she was realizing there were charges on her card and she contacted the authorities and her bank and everything and explained what had been going on. Police got wind of this. They got in contact with the people from the pizza place. They knew who this person was that was claiming to be, you know, so-and-so. They set up like a sting operation, I guess you could say. The police were very eager to find out like who this person was. And needless to say, they would find out that it was Maura Murray, a college student. They would bring her in and they didn't put like handcuffs on her. So I don't want to say they arrested her, but they brought her in and obviously said like, hey, we know this isn't your credit card account number. They did take her mugshot. And a lot of people have like a lot of like feelings about this mugshot, which if you go to crimeghoul_, you could take a look at the mugshot because I posted it. Or if you have me on Facebook or Twitter, you'll see it there as well. Maura does not look like herself in this, you know, mugshot. And to me, that's not really surprising because you could look at so many people. They're like caught by the police and their mugshot is taken. A lot of them don't look like themselves. They're in a state of distress, embarrassment, whatever. Some people look really good in their mugshot. So it all depends. So I wouldn't be surprised if Maura wasn't looking like herself because it's embarrassing. Like I said before, if I was like caught doing something like that and had to get a mugshot taken, one, I would just be thinking about my family and what they think of me. I would be thinking like, wow, why did I do this? I'm embarrassed. I'm annoyed at myself. Like, you know, there's so many reasons somebody might not look like themselves in a picture. But for some reason, it's very like harrowing for some people. So you could take a look at it and, you know, let me know what you think. Police said that she was very cooperative. She was very nice. She was very apologetic. And, you know, it went smoothly. Like she signed off on the receipt. She admitted to it. She had to pay back whatever the amount was. I think it was like $79.02. And, you know, that was it. If she had like good behavior for like the next 3 months, like the charges would be dropped. Okay, so she was charged with something. Anyway, if she was just good for 3 months, we can expunge that. We're not gonna like hold it against you. So it was looking good for Maura. This was like best case scenario, honestly. Of course, many people speculate to this day, like, why was she doing this? Because we don't have an answer. And like I said, her family probably knows. But just to give you an idea of like what has been floating around, and listen, what has been floating around. Okay. What I mean by that is things that have been said. We have no confirmation about these things, but people were wondering like, okay, so Maura ordered more food than she could consume on her own. So was she ordering food for other people? Some people said that Maura was struggling with bulimia, and I can't find like a concrete source stating that, but that's like what's in the rumor mill. Again, rumors, people, please do not take this as like a concrete, like solidified fact, because it's not. But people try to make sense of it. So was she experiencing or struggling with bulimia? Obviously, for some people, when you are bulimic, there's binging and purging. So, you know, if you're binging and you're binge eating, you are eating as much food as you possibly can. Like that's kind of what happens. So people are wondering if that's what was going on, or, you know, like, did she have difficulty obtaining food? Was this her way of having food over a course of time? I don't know, but she was employed. So where would her money be going? You know, if it wasn't going to food and necessities, who really knows? But nonetheless, she was almost charged with credit card fraud, like indefinitely. So that would have really screwed her. You know, credit card fraud does not look good for anybody. Thankfully, it was looking like she was on a good path. She was going to behave and all of this hoo-ha would just disappear and she would never have to worry about it again. But unfortunately, bigger problems were ahead for Miss Maura. It has been said that Maura was experiencing some inner struggles, like struggles with her everyday life outside of school, outside of work and sports. Maura had 7 childhood friends from her hometown of Hanson, Massachusetts, and they were pretty close-knit. They stayed that way even while being away at college. And she would confide in them about her long-distance relationship with Billy, which, like I mentioned before, it was a really good relationship, but it was also kind of toxic at points. A lot of people experience that. She also had a friend in school that she confided in as well, and apparently she had been having an affair with one of the assistant coaches. I'm not going to go too deep into that. All you really need to know is his name was Hussein Baghdadi, and he was one of the track coaches at UMass. So that's where Maura was running, and that's how she got to know him. And later, Haas, that's what he would go by, was very candid and admitted to the affair. He admitted seeing Maura when she and Bill were on a break for a little while, which is a pretty brief period of time, but he also admitted to being together with her while Bill and Maura were still in a relationship. So Haas mentioned that Maura talked about running away and starting a new life, and that she mentioned she would possibly do it in Mexico. So it's either he could be telling the truth, and that's exactly what she said, or he's lying. But police would end up clearing him of any involvement with the case, like, later on down the line. So that's why I'm not going to go into it too much. He had an alibi when she goes missing, so it really couldn't have been him. He didn't have a whole lot to gain by admitting that he was in a relationship or an affair with Maura, and he had no history of ill will towards anybody. So as I said, Maura would confide in her friends from home and some friends from school about her long-distance relationship with Billy. And she would explain that it could be really hard and that when she would see Billy, it was starting to feel like she was getting to know him all over again. Maura and Billy kept in touch using cell phones. They called each other frequently, and Billy had bought Maura a cell phone for Christmas, and his mom, Sharon, had gifted Maura with a prepaid call card, so it would be easier for her to contact Billy, and the phone bill would be less money, because Billy did pay for the phone bill. There are rumors that Billy had cheated on Maura at some point, and a true crime author by the name of James Renner, who I used to really enjoy up until recently, and finding out some information about his involvement with this case. I'm not going to go there, though, because this is about Maura Murray. He has stated that there was an email that Maura would leave behind in her dorm room, and it was a confirmation that Billy had cheated on Maura. But besides James Renner, I can't get anybody to confirm that. I haven't found any information suggesting that or confirming it. I know that the two had been on a break before. I know that it wasn't always easy being in a long-distance relationship, and I know that Billy Roche would have some hardships later on in life and got mixed up in a sexual abuse incident. And I will dive into that. I will talk about the charges and whatnot. But other than that, the only thing I know about Maura and Billy's relationship is that it could be hard at times, and that they had been in talks about marriage before, and they were planning the upcoming summer together, and that they wanted to meet up for Valentine's Day, but Billy was stationed in Oklahoma and could not get leave to do so. So Maura had been stressed about her relationship before. Could it be possible that before her disappearance, she was also stressed about the relationship? Perhaps. She was also stressed about her car. She had a black 1996 Saturn, and it was falling apart. It was really on the verge of, like, breaking down all of the time. She needed a new car. It had been so bad that her one friend had been driving her to clinicals because her car was not reliable enough to do so. So Fred Murray would actually go and visit his daughter once a month, so he decided to go visit to help her find a car. So now we're getting closer to the disappearance, and this is where a few events stand out. So I'm going to try to break these down as best as I can. I might be going back a little bit as I tell you about the dates and the times. Like, I might overlap a little bit, so forgive me, and this is the time where you want to really pay attention. So on the night of February 5th, 2004, this was a Thursday night, a couple of things stand out from that evening going into February 6th. So Maura was working a late night as student security in a dormitory hall where she sat at the security desk, took phone calls, helped students, what have you. So Maura wasn't really allowed to be on her personal phone while working, but do we ever listen? No. All of us are using our phones at work when we're maybe not supposed to. So Maura would end up having a 20-minute phone call with her boyfriend Billy, and this was around 7 p.m. She had talked to him quite frequently. She would later talk to him again around 9:56 p.m., and that was a 6-minute phone call with him. I'm guessing on a Thursday night, it's really not that busy. People are probably in their dorm room getting ready for classes on Friday, which classes would inevitably be canceled on Friday due to snow, but that's neither here nor there right now. From around 10:10 p.m. to 10:30 p.m., Maura's on the phone with her sister Kathleen, and they were talking about boy problems. This was a cell phone call. So they were going over, like, you know, what's going on in their relationships. Kathleen had been in a relationship, and they were just shooting the shit, I guess. A little after midnight, from 12:07 to 12:14 a.m., she's on the phone with Billy again. This was using her cell phone. And then around 12:40 a.m., someone calls the security desk, and we're not sure who it is. It could be a student for all we know. Maybe it's Kathleen. Who really knows? But by 1 a.m., Maura is seen sobbing uncontrollably. Her supervisor, Karen, saw this and asked her what was wrong, and Maura was just crying, and she was staring ahead, almost in like a trance-like state. She started pointing to her phone and would say, "My sister." But she did this, obviously, in a more emotional and sad way, like, "Oh, my sister," like, crying, all of that. And Karen would be like, "You know what, Maura, it's okay. Like, why don't you go home? You shouldn't be working in this state. Let me walk you to your dorm." So she walks Maura back to her dorm, and she asks if she could go upstairs and stay with Maura for a little while until she calmed down, just to comfort her. And Maura was like, "No, thank you. My roommate is home. I'll be okay, whatever." But here's the thing, Maura doesn't have a roommate. She has her own room. I mean, there are people who live in the dorm, but she doesn't have a roommate, so she lied. So obviously, looking back at this case, people want to know why Maura was sobbing uncontrollably. Like, what was told to her that made her so upset? And it was told to her by her sister. Like, what could that be? So if we go back in time, let's go back to 10:10 p.m., she was actually on a break when she called Kathleen. And she wouldn't cry until 1 p.m. Obviously, she got that phone call at the student security desk on the campus phone at 12:40. So was it that phone call that made her upset? Was it Kathleen on the phone calling her on the campus phone? I'm not really sure. You know, she doesn't have any calls on her cell phone after that. So I'm wondering if maybe Maura's phone died and Kathleen called her. I'm not sure, but nothing else really makes sense because she had talked to Kathleen around 10 to 10:30. She wouldn't be crying uncontrollably about her sister until 1 o'clock. The only relevant thing is at 12:40, she received a call on the campus phone. And it is a Thursday night. What student is really calling the security desk? I mean, it's possible, but, you know, I'm just saying, like, what really sparked that? Something else that's really noteworthy, around 12:20 a.m., so right after midnight, a UMass student is hit by a car. There's a hit and run, and the student is unconscious laying on the side of the road. His name is Patrit Vassy, and he would be in the hospital for a while after that. He did survive his injuries, but, you know, that was something noteworthy. Many people wondered and speculated, could Maura have been the person who hit Patrice? But around 12:07 to 12:14 a.m., that's when she's on the phone with Billy. And later, investigators would speak to Karen, her supervisor, who would state there's no way Maura could have went from the security desk on foot to her car and then to hit Patrit Vassy, put her car somewhere, and then to go back to work. Like, the time just doesn't add up. She wouldn't have had the time to do it. So one has to believe that that 12:40 phone call, whatever it was, had to be what made Maura upset. Unless she was thinking about what she and Kathleen had talked about around a little after 10 o'clock when they had that phone call on break, it's possible that maybe that's what made her cry. Not really sure, but we know that Maura was very upset. So February 6th, you know, later on in the morning, like I said, classes were canceled due to the snow, inclement weather, all of that. So there's really not much activity on Maura's part. We do get some activity from call logs. So around 6:01 p.m. on the 6th, which is a Friday, I'm going to just keep stressing the days and the dates because it could get confusing. But 6:01 p.m., she calls to check her voicemail. At 6:13 p.m., she gets an incoming call from someone, and we don't know who that person is, but it lasts for 17 minutes. And by 10:02 p.m., she gets a call from Fort Sill, Oklahoma, which is where Billy is stationed, so we can probably guess that her and Billy were on the phone for about 10 minutes. But that brings us to February 7th, 2004, which is a Saturday. And buckle up, Buttercup, because this is where it gets a little dicey, and this is where we get into the thick of our story. Into the thick of it, into the thick of it. Sorry, TikTok problems. Anyway, so we're getting into the thick of the story here, kids. So like I already said, Fred Murray would go to visit Maura once a month, and this time it was going to be to search for a new car. Many people have a problem with this because allegedly Maura did not tell any of her friends that she was getting a new car. I don't know why that's such a big deal. Some people think it's weird. It's like, oh, you're going to get a new car. Why wouldn't you tell your friends? But there's so many reasons why you might not tell your friends. It could be that maybe you're embarrassed because you have to get a used car. I don't know. I don't know if she's trying to live up to some expectations. Who knows? But for whatever reason, she didn't share it with any friends. Some of her friends said that Maura was a very open person and she would share this kind of information. But again, like, who knows? We don't really know. Nonetheless, Fred Murray states that that was the plan. He was going up there to help get her a new car. And we do all know that Maura's car was a shit show. That Black Saturn was about to break down. It was really at the end of its life. And Billy Roche would even agree to this. He agreed to the poor condition of the Saturn. So that's the information we have to go off of. So allegedly, Fred took out $4,000 to go car hunting with Maura. But you see, it was a Saturday when he had to take out money for this. So he actually had to go to 10 different ATMs to take out the money because at the time, like, banks weren't open on Saturdays. So some people also thought it was weird. Like, okay, he had to go to 10 ATMs to take out $4,000. And just to let you guys know, they wouldn't end up getting a car that day. So some people were like, did he take the money out and give it to his daughter? So, all right, I'm going to try not to jump too far ahead, but just keep that in mind. So by 4:13 p.m., there's a 3-minute phone call to Reliance Auto. Obviously, I'm sure they're asking, like, hey, do you have any cars available? What do you have available? And Maura and Fred allegedly spent the day looking for the car. And after looking for the car, a new car, they went to a local brew house or brew pub, whatever you want to call it, for dinner. And Fred asked Maura if he would like to bring a friend, and she was like, yeah. And she decided to bring her closest friend, Kate. Her second closest friend at UMass, her name was Sarah, but she was definitely closer to Kate. So Fred treated Maura and her friend, Kate, to dinner. They had a good time. The food was great. And after that, they made a quick stop to the liquor store. Kate was a senior in college. Maura was a junior. Both were of age to drink. So they went into the liquor store, bought a couple of bottles because they planned to go to a party that evening. So the party was allegedly at Sarah's dorm room, but there's a lot of weirdness about that. So just hold your horses there. So they were planning on going to a party. Maura dropped off Kate, so I guess Kate could get ready. She dropped off Fred to his motel, and Fred allowed her to borrow his car, which was a brand new Toyota Corolla. So this was a nice car. I'm sure Maura was happy to be driving it. I'm going to guess that Maura went back to her dorm room to get ready for this party. So she would eventually go pick up Kate to go to this party. She drove the both of them to Sarah's dorm room. And there's not much known about this party. The only thing we do know is that Kate and Sarah have trouble recalling the night and who was there. I mean, it makes sense if you're getting super drunk at a college party. Are you really going to remember who's there? Maybe you will. I don't know if they really had close friends. We don't know much about Kate and Sarah, to be honest. But from what I can tell, they honestly have a hard time recalling the party. But I don't know. For Sarah not to remember who was there, she's the one who threw the party. Like, it's a little weird, in my opinion. So who knows if the party was a very important part of this story. But nevertheless, Maura ends up leaving the party at 2:30 a.m. in that new Toyota Corolla. Around 3:30 a.m., she makes a call to University of Massachusetts police. It turns out she veered off the road and she hit a guardrail in Fred's new car, which was about $10,000 worth of damage. So yeah, that's a pretty scary situation. By 3:37 a.m., an officer shows up to the call and responds, and you know, he takes a look. I'm guessing Maura isn't super intoxicated because he's able to make the call that the roads were really icy and that's why she veered off the road. She didn't get arrested for a DUI or anything. It was just a lot of damage. And by 4:29 a.m., a tow truck leaves with Maura and the Toyota. So she had used AAA and, Yeah, she was getting towed back to her dad's motel. By 4:45 a.m., the tow truck drops her off at her dad's motel. And she wakes her dad up and explains what happened. She's in a very distressed state. She's so upset, very apologetic. This was a lot of damage, like $10,000 is a lot of money. By 5:38 a.m., Maura calls Billy from Fred's cell phone, possibly because her phone was dead, but she stays on the phone for 11 minutes with him and is telling him about what happened, and she's just very upset. And Billy recalls talking to her, and, you know, he assures her, like, it's gonna be okay, don't worry, like, really talks her off the edge because she's upset. By 5:49 a.m., Billy calls her cell phone, and they have actually calls back Fred's cell phone, and they have another 5-minute conversation. So that morning, Maura's just like very upset. She feels very shitty. And her dad's like, listen, I'm going to call the insurance company. I'm going to see if this would be covered, you know, like whatever. Fred seemed to take it pretty well. Honestly, he seemed to be very chill and relaxed about it. And, you know, after making a couple of phone calls, he finds that insurance should cover it. And he tells Maura, like, listen, it's okay. Like, that's what we have insurance for. Around 1 to 1:30 p.m. on that Sunday, Fred drops Maura off at her dorm. So he reassures her and says, listen, like, I know you're upset, because he could feel how upset Maura is. He explained that everything was going to be all right. And he could sense that Maura felt maybe like she let her dad down. And he said, listen, go pick up the forms to make it like an accident report or a claim with the insurance. You just have to go to the DMV to pick up those forms. It turned out that he and Maura did find a car she was interested in and that she wanted. And he stated that he would be back the following weekend to purchase it. Many people wonder why they didn't just purchase it on Saturday when they found it. I'm guessing that maybe it was more money than they expected. And he had already been to 10 different ATMs to take out money. So that could be it. And maybe it was an excuse for Fred to come back. So that's what I'm guessing. But Fred would end up taking a rental car back to Connecticut. Because that's where he worked, in the state of Connecticut. So he dropped her off. And again, he said that he could tell she was upset, and he had a feeling that she had been maybe a little depressed and that stuff was going on in her social life. So Maura said bye to her dad. She got out of the car and she walked into her dorm. And Fred Murray did not know it at the time, but that would be the last time that he would ever see his daughter. By 8:37 p.m. that Sunday, Maura calls and checks her voicemail. By 11:26 p.m., Maura calls her dad and they have a conversation. They talked on the phone about the insurance again. And, you know, he said, you know, just make sure you go get the forms and call me tomorrow night around 8 p.m. and I'll help you fill them out. We'll go over them. But Fred would never receive that phone call. It was documented that Maura was on the computer until 4 a.m. She had been looking up some interesting information. She was searching rental properties in New Hampshire and Vermont. Using MapQuest, she actually made a search from Amherst, Massachusetts, which is where UMass is, to Burlington, Vermont. And, you know, she got the directions and all this stuff. It seems like she was planning a little trip there. And it would seem that Maura was really making these plans on her own, because nobody would ever come forward saying that they were aware that Maura was planning to go away. But by 4 a.m. that morning, which now that brings us to February 9th, 2004, Monday morning, she stops using her internet. By 12:55 that afternoon, she calls a condo rental in New Hampshire. The phone call lasts for 3 minutes, and the owner of the condo ends up not renting it to Maura. This is actually a condo she had been to with her family before. She was very familiar with New Hampshire. That's where her and her dad loved to go hiking in the mountains. They would vacation there in the summer and the winter, so she was really well-versed with the area. Around 1 p.m. to 1:30, she sent an email to her boyfriend and she told him that she loved him and apologized for not answering his messages because she didn't feel like talking to anyone. Maura continued to make several phone calls that afternoon. 1-800-GHOSTO was one of them, and at the time that phone line was out of order. The only thing she could do was listen to the listings in that area for places where you can make reservations. It was accommodations like hotel stays, condos, whatever, rentals. 13 minutes after that, she called Billy, but Billy did not answer the phone, so she left a voicemail and promised to call him again, and she explained that she missed him. The only person Maura would share her plans with in any way, which wasn't even really sharing, were her nursing professors. So she would send out an email telling them that she needed to be away for a week due to a death in the family. But later, when this information came out, her friends at school and obviously her family members knew that there was no death in the family. So Maura had lied to her professors, which I could think of a million times I lied to my professors to get out of assignments or, you know, to get out of attending class. So I'm not even surprised. But anyway, that happened. Some people who knew Maura really well did not think this was like her and did not think that she would go on a trip without telling anybody, or she wouldn't plan one without telling anybody. But then one of her closest friends out of that close-knit group of seven that I told you about that were from her hometown, they did mention that one time in high school, she skipped school to go to Boston. She got on a bus like very impulsively and just spent the day in Boston, and nobody knew where she was until she got back later that night and told them. So could it be possible that she was just going on a little trip and didn't want anyone to know? She just wanted that freedom of just getting in the car and going. I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, they always say don't do that for these types of reasons. If you go missing and nobody knows where you are, how are you going to get helped? By 4:37 p.m. Oh no, we're not going to go there yet. So by 3:30 p.m., Maura gets in her black Saturn. It's cold out, and she's ready to embark on a destination. We don't know where she's going. It doesn't seem like she has any accommodations made. And like I said, she was on her way up to Vermont. Like, that's the little path she paved for herself using MapQuest. But she didn't seem to have a place to be going. So that was the interesting part. But nonetheless, she got in the car and she's driving away from UMass. The campus is in the rearview mirror. She is out. She would stop at an ATM where she would withdraw $280, which nearly depleted her bank account. She would stop at a liquor store and she purchased Kahlua, Bailey's vodka, boxed wine. And we know this because there was a receipt found in her car. So these were full bottles that she bought. And she, with the boxed wine, if you've seen like a Franzia box wine, you know, like how much wine there is and how many people like that can, you know, accommodate. It's a big box. That's a lot of wine. Lots of cups or glasses, I guess you could say, in there. So many people wonder what made Maura buy all this alcohol. Again, this is another instance where it seems like she purchased a lot more than she could consume on her own. After purchasing the alcohol, she would check her voicemail twice and continue on. Maura would call Billy, but Billy would not answer the phone. It turns out Billy was actually on the phone with Kate, which is Maura's friend. Kate would later say that he was talking to her about Maura and I guess like confiding in Kate because that was her best friend at UMass. Not really sure, but by that time, you know, Maura did apologize for not getting back to his messages. So maybe he was just a little upset. I don't know. When you're in your early 20s, are you still a little immature? Yeah, you could be. So he might have just been like, is she okay? Do you know what's going on? Blah, 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 blah. Some people find it really weird because like, why are you talking to your girlfriend's best friend? We're not really sure, but apparently it wasn't anything super significant. I mean, at least that's what Billy and Kate say. There are a few more things I want to mention that I forgot to tell you guys before, but not only did Maura notify her professors that she was going to be gone due to a family emergency, but she would actually leave a note at the art gallery where she was supposed to work that day. And she wrote that there was a death in the family and she would be gone for a week. So she left that for her supervisor to find. On top of that, she had borrowed a lab coat from a friend and she called her friend, asked if she could drop it off. And her friend was like, oh, it's really not a big deal. I wasn't even expecting you to, you know, give it back. It was an extra coat she had and she just gave it to Maura. But Maura would end up going to her friend's dorm. She knocked on the door. Her friend would be sleeping, so she didn't answer the door. And Maura just left like the coat in a plastic bag in front of the door that her friend would get later. When she woke up and opened the door, she saw it was there. So that's just a few details that might be something important. So Maura had a couple of things packed with her. She had clothing packed, toiletries, college textbooks, and birth control pills. Classes did just start, so she had all of her books that she needed, I guess, and a syllabus. So at this point, after Maura goes to the liquor store, she is on Interstate 91 North. She is going up to Vermont. And sometime after 7 p.m., a Woodsville, New Hampshire resident heard a very loud thump outside of her house. She ran to her window and looked outside, and she saw a car up against a snowbank along Route 112. Also known as Wild Amnesuck Road. I definitely pronounced that wrong, but yeah. So the car was pointed west on the eastbound side of the road. At 7:27 p.m., the local woman reported the car accident on the sharp corner of Route 112. She telephoned the Grafton County Sheriff's Department, and at 7:27, the report of the accident was documented. According to the 911 log, the woman claimed to have seen a man smoking a cigarette inside of the car. So this was interesting. Did Maura have somebody in the car with her? But later, that same person who reported it stated that she had not seen a man nor a person smoking a cigarette, but rather had seen what appeared to be a red light glowing from inside the car, which potentially could be a cell phone. So the woman who made that police call was Faith Westman. She was a resident of Haverhill, New Hampshire. She stated that it looked like her car, Maura's car, was stuck in a ditch. Shortly after that, a bus driver named Butch Atwood drove by and spoke to Maura, so he claims. He offered her help and asked if she needed him to call the police, but she declined his offer and said that she had already called AAA. But Butch knew that there was absolutely no cell reception in that area, because you see, that road, 112, was popular in the sense that a lot of people would drive along it, but it was a very remote area, and there was no way that she had cell reception to call AAA. So Butch Atwood was worried about Maura, and he drove about 100 yards east of the accident to his house. He parked his bus, and he went inside to call police, and he told his wife, like, what had happened. So let's get a better understanding of this car crash. So Butch Atwood's call was made at 7:42 p.m., and police asked if the woman in the car appeared injured, and Butch told police that she appeared shaken up and that the airbags had deployed, but he saw no blood. So I guess he was thinking it wasn't like a super serious injury, but she was definitely scared. So by the time the first officer arrived on scene at 7:46, Maura had been gone, okay? So later, Faith, that first woman who called, said that she had watched like out the window and she saw Butch Atwood stop to speak to Maura, and then she left the window and walked away. Butch had talked to Maura, went home, told his wife, called 911. So all in that time, in around 7 minutes, if that, police get there and Maura's gone. So the officer who arrived at the scene noted that the car had been locked, but he could see a box of red wine behind the driver's seat, as well as stains on the ceiling and door. It looked like red stains. He eventually did get inside of the car, and there was a Coke bottle that appeared to have a red liquid in it. And very strangely, he noticed that there was a rag stuffed in Maura's tailpipe. Later, we would find that Fred had advised Maura to do so in order to avoid being ticketed by police for excessive smoke coming out of the tailpipe. So as you can see, this car was in really bad shape and had no business being driven all the way to Vermont from Massachusetts. According to the official police log at 7:46 p.m., when the police arrived, the woman driver was nowhere to be seen. They noticed that the car had impacted the tree on the driver's side of the vehicle, severely damaging the left headlight and pushing the car's radiator into the fan, so rendering the car inoperable. So there's no way the car would have moved or anything like that. They also noted that the car's windshield was cracked on the driver's side and both airbags had deployed, like Butch Atwood said. Another thing they found when they got inside the car was an empty beer bottle. The box of Franzia wine was damaged. In addition, a AAA card was found, and it was issued to Maura Murray. There were blank accident report forms, gloves, like snow gloves, compact discs, makeup, diamond jewelry, driving directions to Burlington, Vermont, and Maura's favorite stuffed animal. She also had a book that was titled Not Without Peril, and this was a book about climbing the White Mountains. So this is people like who made it through climbing the White Mountains, people who went missing while climbing the White Mountains, all of that. There were a few things missing from the car. Maura's debit card was gone, her credit card was gone, her cell phone was gone, and still to this day, none of those have been located. She also was known for traveling with a black backpack, and that was nowhere to be found either, not in her dorm or in her car. Based on the receipt from the liquor store she went to and, you know, the alcohol she purchased, some of the liquor bottles were missing. So it can be really difficult to understand, like, or visualize how this, you know, car accident happened. Because on one hand, we have the first woman saying that it looked like the car hit a snowbank and went into a ditch, but then the police get there and say she hit into a tree. So basically, at a hairpin turn, Maura went off the road, her car hit a tree. At that point, a person came along who was driving a bus, Butch Atwood. He asked her if she needed help. She refused, and about 10 minutes later, police showed up to the scene and Maura Murray was gone. So yeah, Butch Atwood would say that he made that 911 call and he didn't look back until police got there. And by that time, the woman was missing. Police were able to trace the vehicle to Murray and initially treated her as a missing person on the belief that she may have wanted to disappear voluntarily from the scene. So is this so hard-fetched for us to believe at first, okay? Let's take a look back. So within the prior 4 days to Maura going missing, what happened? Well, she was crying hysterically on the phone, sobbing about something that had to do with her sister. Then she crashed her father's brand new Toyota Corolla. In the months prior, she had gotten in trouble for credit card fraud. And, you know, before that, she had to transfer from West Point to UMass for theft. So we could see that a lot was going on in Maura's life. I think it's super important to know more about the call she had with Kathleen. So I'm going to talk about that really quick. So Kathleen Murray did an interview with Oxygen, and that's basically the best insight we have into the phone call. And the truth is, Kathleen had little or no recollection of the phone call at all. She said at the time she was mixing sleeping pills with alcohol heavily, which definitely would have compromised her ability to have a coherent conversation with Maura, much less remember any of it. She also recalled not being able to remember why Maura would have called her that night or what could have made Maura reportedly catatonic after the call and mumbling, "Oh, my sister," to her supervisor. So apparently Kathleen was having substance abuse issues, and some people wonder if maybe Maura was upset that her sister relapsed or was upset that she heard her sister in that state. The thing is, we can't be sure. We don't know. Only Maura knows. The main point here is that Maura clearly had a lot going on, whether she was upset about her relationship with Billy for whatever reason, whether she was upset about Kathleen. Maybe this was overwhelming on top of the fact that she just crashed her father's car and cost $10,000 worth of damage. And now just 2 days later, she crashes her car in New Hampshire. Plus, all of the other past history she's had under her belt, from theft to credit card fraud, like who knows what was going through her mind. But here we are at this point, and now Maura is missing from the crime scene. Could it have been that she was trying to avoid the police after all of this stuff had happened? And could it be that from the overwhelming stress maybe of her relationship, of her feelings about her sister, from full-time work to balancing two jobs and sports, having an affair, like all of these things, like could it be that Maura just needed a break and that's why she was making her way to one of her most favorite places, which was Vermont and, you know, near the New Hampshire area? So by 7:54 p.m., the police released a be on the lookout for a female who was 5'7 on foot. They were wondering where this woman could have went. She was here minutes ago, and you know, that's what witnesses are saying. One witness said he spoke to her. Like, where could she have gone? So by 7:56 p.m., EMS arrives. By 7:57 p.m., the fire department arrives, just in case, I guess, they're needed for any emergency services. By 8 p.m., there's a call from Billy Roche to Bob McDonald, which was one of his friends, and the phone call lasts for 34 minutes. Some people would say that this was interesting because it happened right after the accident, but Bob McDonald and Billy both say that Maura was never discussed nor mentioned in their phone call. So I think this is just a red herring people try to throw in there. By 8:02 p.m., of course, because nobody's there, there's no fire, nobody's injured, the main officer, who's Officer Cecil, directs EMS and fire to leave. They're not needed. By 9:26 p.m., the officer leaves the scene to respond to another 911 call. So a couple of things about the police department that pop up as red flags would be that Officer Cecil apparently was known for being drunk on the job and being an alcoholic. So as time goes by and Maura is not found, people start to wonder and speculate about the police department. They dig into their background and they wonder if maybe this officer or a officer hit Maura while she was in the road and covered up the scene and said that she just disappeared. And really, they know where she is and they like buried her or something like that. Remember, this is just pure speculation, and I have no confirmation on this claim, but this is just something that came up. People were wondering if this was a police cover-up. Also, it gets weird because apparently in that area of New Hampshire, there's two tow truck companies, and they would switch shifts, you know, I guess to make it even for business and everything. And basically, the tow truck that was supposed to be on call for towing was not the tow truck company that was called. It was the other one. So people were wondering if maybe the police had a better rapport with this tow company that they called, and they believed that they could keep a secret and they would hide, you know, whatever details about Mora being hit by them or something, you know, in a car. So regardless, this ended up being thrown out. There was an interview done with the tow truck driver on Oxygen, and he would state that it was just another night on the job. He got the call and he went and he helped. He didn't know why he was called, and officers really didn't think it was a big deal. They just thought about this tow truck driver and called him first. So who knows? You could look into that further if you want. But again, this is all just theory speculation. So a lot of things that happened in this case made finding Mora difficult. So from the moment she goes missing, you know, they put out that be on the lookout from around 8 p.m. until the next day. Police do not get in touch with Mora's family. Reportedly, they try to get in touch with Fred Murray, but they're not able to reach him. And they somehow end up getting in touch with Kathleen. So they tell Kathleen what happened, that Mora was in an accident. And when they got to the scene, she was gone. She is missing. So Kathleen notified her whole family, and of course they were up in arms. They were terrified. They had no idea what was going on. They notified Billy. Billy had no idea why she would have been up there. Everybody's wondering, why was Mora miles and miles away from UMass? Nobody knew she was planning a trip. Nobody knew she was going anywhere. And it was very unlike her not to tell anybody. But again, if we remember back to the whole Boston incident, she didn't tell anybody during that time either. She just got on a bus, skipped school, and went to Boston. So Mora was also known for being a very adventurous person. It sounds like maybe she was spontaneous as well. So needless to say, the family's freaking out, and Fred Murray makes his way up to New Hampshire immediately. He wastes no time. At first, Lori Murray could not join the search for Mora because her ankle was broken. So she had to stay home for a little bit, but eventually the whole family would go up to New Hampshire to start searching for Mora. Billy also went all the way up to New Hampshire. He was able to get like a leave of absence, you know, due to a family emergency to go search for her. So really the trail had gone cold and there was a huge gap of time. Had they called the Murrays right after the accident and the incident, maybe the trail would have been fresh. Maybe they could have done something. Who knows what more they could have done, though? They weren't in New Hampshire. I guess Fred could have driven there sooner and, you know, maybe he could have figured something out. But police had already investigated the scene and there were no footprints in the snow. So they didn't think that she ran into the woods, which remember, this is a very remote area. There are like three houses around the crash site, but other than that, it's dense woods, and Mora was smart. She was an outdoors woman. She loved nature, very athletic, in amazing shape. She wouldn't have gone into the woods at night, but some people think maybe she did. Maybe she was like hiding from the police and she ran into the woods, or because of the crack on the windshield, maybe that was due to her head hitting the windshield and she got scared, ran into the woods, and, you know, ended up dying in the woods. But honestly, they would have found her body if that was the case. She wouldn't have made it very far. And even if she did, like, they covered a pretty extensive amount of the area at first. Not too crazy, but like, how far could she have gone in 7 minutes on foot? Really couldn't have gone that far. But I guess she could have just went further and further throughout the night. So it's hard to say. But by the following day, police searched her computer, and that's how they found all the information from MapQuest and, you know, the trip she was planning, what she was looking up, and so on and so forth. They were waiting for phone records because, like I said, Billy's the one who paid for Mora's phone, so thankfully they were able to get those call records. And once they eventually got them, they would start calling those people to try to get more information. By February 11th, Billy and his family arrived in New Hampshire. His parents came with him to search for Mora. He was actually interrogated by the police, and then he was interrogated a second time and was accompanied by his parents for this interrogation. Obviously, he had a very tight alibi. He was in Oklahoma. He was not in New Hampshire. So he was telling police, like, I don't know anything. I don't know why she would drive all the way up here. She didn't tell me anything about it. He clearly had no clue, you know, what was going on. Neither did the family, so obviously it didn't seem like there was any foul play that Billy could have been involved with. Something strange did happen to Billy on February 11th. When he landed at the airport with his parents, he saw that he had a voicemail, and it was from an unknown number, And he listened to it and he described it sounding like muffling crying and like just really weird, creepy noises. And he was wondering if it was Maura. So obviously he brought this to the police's attention. And when they traced the call, it went back to the Red Cross, which was interesting. It would later be discovered that apparently the Red Cross was in charge of getting in touch with military personnel if they were going on emergency leave. So that's what the call was. And apparently it was just inaudible. It was just really creepy, though, because, of course, Billy was scared that this was Maura and it sounded like a very distorted phone call. By February 19th, the crash scene and the area is searched by the family extensively and by police. The case ends up going national, and now Maura's face is all over the news, the FBI is involved, and a lot of speculation and rumors are going around. By February 26th, white panties are found near the search. So this was really scary. People were wondering if this underwear could have belonged to Maura. The underwear had been ripped, and the underwear was given to police. There was not much of a development there, but later police would find that the DNA did not match that of Maura's and confirm that it was not belonging to Maura Murray. And at the end of February, the police returned the items found in Maura's car to her family. By March 2nd, 2004, the Murray family and the Roche family leave New Hampshire. There's no sign of Maura anywhere. They talk to witnesses who were involved, and there's just nothing to go off of. Fred Murray would end up returning almost every weekend searching for Maura. To this day, we do not know the whereabouts of Maura Murray. So why are so people obsessed with this case? Well, I don't know about you, but it drives me absolutely crazy that we don't know where this girl went. How I see it, she was really overwhelmed. She had a lot going on. To me, it seems like she was trying to get away. Like she just wanted to go on a little trip. And I've been there. I've been in that situation where I just needed to get away. I've been in the situation where I didn't tell anybody where I was going. I wouldn't be gone for like a whole day or days. It would just be a few hours, which I really advise against that. Always tell somebody where you're going, even when you're feeling really stressed. The thing is, it feels so liberating when you just go out somewhere and there's something very freeing about the idea that nobody knows where you are. But it could lead to something as tragic as this, which is why it's so important to always tell people where you're going, especially if you're going alone. But looking at what she had in her car, she had some clothes packed, not enough to run away or go anywhere for a long period of time. She had her textbooks and a syllabus with her, so it was clear that she was looking to do homework. Before she left UMass, she submitted homework. She let her professors know that she was going to be gone for the week. It's not like she said she was just leaving school permanently. It seemed like she was just going for like a 3-day getaway or some short getaway. It really didn't seem like it was supposed to be permanent. A lot of speculation has been thrown into this case, like I've mentioned. I've mentioned a couple of the theories. A lot of people freak out about the rag and the tailpipe, but when you look at the investigation and you find that Fred Murray did confirm that he told Maura to stuff that in there if, you know, the smoke was just getting too much so she could avoid being pulled over, it makes sense. Some people wonder that if, you know, stuffing the rag in the car caused carbon monoxide to go into the car and that's what led to her veering off the road. We're not sure. It was New Hampshire in February, which it's freezing, it's cold, the roads are windy and they're known to get icy. So could it have been that Maura, you know, hit a patch of ice and she veered off the road and that's how she hit into, you know, whatever? It could be. And could that be the reason why she got into a car accident back in Massachusetts just a few days prior? She hit a patch of ice. It was a very cold month. So it could all make sense. But then other people wonder, like, was she drunk? Like driving drunk, you know, there was wine spilt on the car, in the car, the box of wine was open, there was an empty beer bottle. Could she have been drinking and driving and she veered off the road because she was drunk? Yeah, I guess that could have been something, but from what people say, she didn't struggle with alcohol. So there's that. So it's hard to say, it's hard to know. You know, Billy Roush was questioned and interrogated and there was nothing that came up that could have upset Maura so much that would, you know, get her to disappear, or well, not disappear, but make her want to disappear or run off. So it's really, really weird. It just, to me, sounds like she was going away for a weekend and she loved Vermont. She had that book, Without Peril. She clearly loved hiking. Maybe she was just going to clear her head. especially because the semester had just started, classes had just started. Maybe she didn't feel like she was in the right headspace for, you know, classes to begin. For the police, their biggest thing was, listen, she's a 21-year-old. If she wants to go missing, she's allowed to do that. But again, Maura's family was like, no, this wouldn't happen. She loves us. She wouldn't just abandon us. So I think it's really important to listen to the family, because who knows you better? I know if one of my siblings just went missing and people were trying to tell me, oh, they just wanted to run away, like, I know they wouldn't just go without telling me. And I would hope they would think the same of me. I wouldn't just disappear without telling them where I was going. But let's play that side of the fence. Let's say she was running away. What would be her reasons? Would you just run away because you were having problems in your relationship? Would you run away because you didn't like the person you were? I guess that's possible. I could see that. Could there have been something going on that made Maura really upset? Some people claim that maybe she was pregnant. I don't know about all that. I feel like she would have told somebody. Unless she was just really embarrassed of all of the things that have gone wrong in her life or the bad decisions she's made. Maybe this was just another bad decision under her belt. But we have no concrete proof or evidence that she could have been pregnant. The other thing, you know, that guy Haas I told you about, the assistant coach, he did claim that Maura had talked about running away to, like, Mexico. But, I mean, how many of us have talked about that? For me, I talk about running away to Fiji all the time and living off the land. So would that be that surprising? You know, just joking around or talking about that? Like, is it something you should take literally? I guess when somebody goes missing, it's not far-fetched to take it literally and to wonder. Maybe she was afraid of going to jail. You know, you look at the fact that she got into 2 car accidents within 3 days. We look at the possibility of people, like, having rumors that she was the one who hit that student at UMass, even though people say that there's no way it could have been her. Who knows? Like, I guess that could make you want to run away to evade police and law enforcement. But then you wonder, was she going to meet somebody? That's a whole other, like, can of worms. But we have no evidence to suggest that she was going to meet with somebody. The only evidence we have is that she bought $40 worth of liquor. You know, big bottles, a big box of wine. Was she going to drink that with somebody? Could that be possible? I suppose it could be. Then you have to wonder, she disappeared from the site so quickly. Like, could she have disappeared that quickly on foot? I guess she could have if she went into the woods. But again, there were no footprints in the snow. There was no sign of her going into the woods. Could she have been picked up by somebody? That's possible. Maybe she hitched a ride with somebody. Some people wonder because, you know, at first that woman Faith said that it looked like somebody was smoking a cigarette in the passenger seat. So could somebody have been in the car with her? I mean, perhaps, but Butch Atwood said he only saw her. He didn't see another person. Then the fingers point to Butch Atwood. People wondered if he killed her, if he abducted her. And I mean, could that be possible? I guess so, because that woman Faith looked out the window until she saw Butch Atwood, her neighbor, speak to Maura, then she turned her back. And when she looked again, it was the police knocking on the door to say, hey, like, do you know where this woman is? And she was like dumbfounded, like, what do you mean? She was just there. She just crashed a few minutes ago. How is she not there anymore? So Butch lives 150 yards, I mean, from the crash site. Could he have time to have abducted her and brought her home? I'm sure he could have, but wouldn't his wife have said something, you would think. So speaking of abductions, could it be that somebody, some random person, just picked her up and abducted her? I mean, yeah, I guess it could be the case, but how likely is that? I mean, it's not impossible. It could happen, but the likeliness of that, that's the question. But at the same time, a few months later, someone by the name of Brianna Maitland would vanish in New Hampshire. And to this day, we still don't know her whereabouts. She didn't live too far away. I think it was like 30 or 40 minutes away from where Maura Murray went missing. But police would later rule that out and say that they had no connection. Don't ask me how they could get to that point. I don't know. But they have access to a whole lot more information and interviewed people that we probably don't even know about. So I mean, I guess if they say they don't think that there's a connection, they're probably more right than I am. Another thing to consider is that serial killer Israel Keyes was known for killing in New Hampshire. And we only know that because that was something he confessed. If you remember, I covered the story, well, the case of Israel Keyes, like episodes way back. So if you're interested, you could go take a look at that. But this man, It was just crazy. He had kill kits like hidden all around the nation. He would end up getting like caught in Alaska, but Needless to say, he had kill kits all over the country and allegedly killed so many people and didn't even confess to everyone he killed. So some people wonder if maybe he kidnapped and killed Mora. And it wouldn't be far-fetched because there are so many missing people he claimed to have killed and never told police where they were. So it could be possible. But again, the likelihood is the question. Unfortunately, Keyes killed himself while in prison, so we can't ask him. So if it was him, we probably will never know. Then people circle back and they point the finger at Billy and they're like, maybe it was Billy. They were having problems in the relationship. Maybe he killed her and whatever hit it. But Billy would not have been able to do this. He had a very strong alibi. He was stationed in Oklahoma. So there's no way he could have went all the way to New Hampshire, which isn't where we think Mora was going. It looked like Mora was going up to Bartlett, Vermont. So he would have had to intercept her somehow, but there's no call on record for him to be able to know where she was going. So that's just not possible. It makes no sense. So why would Billy have killed Mora? What would his motive have been? But Billy is a strange character, and we're almost there, but not quite yet. Some things about this case are really frustrating, though. Mora called somebody asking to rent a condo, and police would not get in touch with this person until 9 months after her disappearance, which it's like, why? Did it really take that long to get call logs? Like, I don't think so. They had other information about who Mora called, and, you know, this condo person was one of the last people Mora spoke to. Well, had spoken to. So by the time they got in touch with her, she was just like, you know, if you guys had asked me when this happened, I would remember. But honestly, I don't really recall. The only thing I can recall is that I wouldn't have rented the condo to her at the time because somebody would have needed to give her the key, or we would have had to leave the keys somewhere for her, and we wouldn't have done that. So she just knows that there's no way she would have rented it out at that time, but she can't remember specifically speaking to somebody. And it was a 3-minute call. Are you really going to remember a 3-minute call like 9 months later when you rent out to people all the time? Probably not. So that was really infuriating. About a year later, one of the people from that area of New Hampshire would come forward. His name was William. He was known in the town. The town is very small. And he would say, oh, you know what? Like, I remember that I saw a woman running that day. But like, this was a year later. So people are like, what the hell, man? You're coming out with this now. Why didn't you say something at the time? And apparently he just wasn't sure if it was Mora, but something happened at work where he was able to verify like the day and time, and he was able to solidify that it was the day Mora got into a crash, and he believes that he saw her running away, running down the road. So there's that. During the beginning phase of the search, police did bring in search dogs, but it wasn't until a few days later, and by that time, there are so many discrepancies with what they could smell and tracking a scent and all of that. So they found gloves in Mora's car, but it was unknown if she had even worn those gloves before, so it's unlikely that they could have gotten a very good scent from those gloves, but needless to say, they were able to track a scent. So the bloodhound that was able to get a scent headed east and stopped down the road within sight of the accident. This track has been quoted as being under about 600 feet to 100 yards and near Butch Atwood's driveway. But then later on in another interview, one of the people who were in charge of Mora's search noted that the dog track ended at the intersection of Bradley Hill Road, which was a little further from Butch Atwood's driveway. So it has been widely quoted that the dog stopped in the middle of the road. So there's many problems with this because Mora's family said that the glove that they took from her car was given to her for Christmas and had barely been worn. They really wish they would have used something else that they had in possession that was Mora's, something like sweaty clothing that would have had more of a scent. Some people speculate that the scent they got was from one of the officers who had searched Mora's car. And if that was the case, he did go to Butch Atwood's house to ask him questions about where she was. So some people think that the dogs inaccurately tracked the officer and not Mora, and he had held the glove as well, so that could be a problem. But then other people speculate that maybe she got into somebody's car and that's why her scent leaves in the middle of the road. When it comes to cases like this, I think you have to think of Occam's razor, which is, it's probably the simplest answer, the simplest explanation. So there's only two. It's either one, Maura ran away, or two, she was met with foul play. Why else would she never be in contact with her family ever again? So I think one of those two theories has to be the explanation. She ran away, or she was picked up by somebody and was met with foul play. Wrong place, wrong time. Her family thinks that it had to be she was met with foul play. And, you know, they've extensively gone through this case. They know that they know Maura, their loved one, their sister, better than anybody else. Her friends agree. She even made plans to go to a concert just a few days after her disappearance with her friends. So would she really have done that if she planned on running away? I mean, I guess if it was an impulse decision, but it really does not seem likely. Of course, her family has gone through these theories, and at the end of the day, they believe that Maura was met with foul play. So I have to agree. I have to say that I think that's probably the most logical explanation. Her family does not believe that the police had done a cover-up. They don't believe she ran away. They don't believe that Billy was to blame and that he was the one who committed the murder. And they have tracked down every tip from people who've stated that they have had Maura Murray sightings. It's happened in Canada. It's happened in Tennessee. It's happened all over the country, all over the world. And every tip just leads to a dead end. Some people have also questioned whether Maura was suicidal, but it doesn't seem that way. I mean, police investigated her dorm and everything seemed to be packed up, but the argument is maybe it wasn't packed up. Maybe she just never unpacked because it was the start of the spring semester. She had been home on winter break, so it could be that she never unpacked anything. So James Renner, the true crime author of True Crime Addict, which has been one of my favorite books, now I have different views after heavily researching this case, because honestly, I became very interested in the Maura Murray case due to his book. I was in Barnes & Noble one day searching the true crime section, and I came upon his book about Maura and his book about Amy Mihaljevic, which I've covered Amy's case in the past. But needless to say, in the book, he actually goes on to accuse Fred Murray of something pretty bad. He doesn't explain what his evidence is, but he states that it's possible Fred was molesting Maura and his daughters. Now, this came with a lot of backlash, of course, from the Murray family and even from the New Yorker. So people have really condemned James Renner's thoughts on the Maura Murray disappearance. And although he seems to be really passionate about the case, there's a lot of things that bother people. And after listening to and watching a lot of interviews of James Renner, I'm actually kind of disappointed as well. Like one thing he said on the Mile Higher podcast, or Mile High podcast, whatever the heck their podcast is called, no disrespect, but in an interview with them, he stated that he's like passionate about missing persons cases until they're found. And then he's like, oh, whatever. Like he doesn't do follow-ups. Like, so do you even really care? Like, or do you just want to be the hero in the story? Like that really ticked me off. But needless to say, Renner has made this weird connection and said that maybe Maura's father is the famous serial killer, the Connecticut River Killer. But the bottom line is that there's no evidence to suggest any molestation or incest that had taken place. Fred actually wrote open letters about this accusation, debunking everything that James Renner had said. So the Murray family and even Maura's friends say that it's absolutely absurd to even accuse Fred Murray of such things. And they were all extremely hurt by James Renner's accusations. So the Murray family has really been through the ringer when it comes to Maura's case. Fred Murray had sued New Hampshire State Police multiple times trying to get the records in regard to Maura's case. But each time he was only given like the bare minimum. And they said that this was to keep the integrity of the case and so on and so forth. And the family understands that to an extent, but they think that if they had the whole case file, they could figure out a whole lot more. They are upset with the police department and how they handled the case. There are a lot of problems with it and with the integrity of the police investigation. However, like I mentioned before, they really don't think that there was any cover-up or anything like that. But they just think that they kind of did a shit job when it came to investigating Maura's disappearance. it seems like they really looked at it as she just left the scene and that's it. She wanted to go out and be on her own, but obviously her family feels otherwise. James Renner has also pointed the finger at Billy Roche, suggesting that he had something to do with Maura's disappearance. And this has caused, like, arguments over Reddit. Like, you could go and look. They're on there. So I'm not going to go too in detail with that. But regardless, like, James Renner has pissed a lot of people off. And to be honest, as a fan of the books and as somebody who tore through the books, I just don't know how to feel about him. I don't think I'm feeling very positive about him after everything I've read. After years went by, there was another lead in the case. So supposedly there was a local man whose family owned a concrete company. Shortly after Maura's disappearance, he allegedly poured cement in his property and no one knew why. So the rumor going around town was that he buried Maura in concrete. So one of the townspeople got in touch with Fred Murray and let him know what was being said in the town. So it was also said that this concrete company owner was directly related to the local district attorney and that his family was very wealthy. He had allegedly been on police radar and denied property searches in the past by police and by the Murray family. It wasn't until 2019 that they no longer lived there, and the new people residing in the house were able to let Fred Murray and the police investigate. So once Fred and police were able to go investigate this claim, two cadaver dogs and ground-penetrating radar equipment pinged the exact location Fred had been tipped about. Strangely, they dug up the concrete and no body was found. Maura's body was not found. Apparently, the only thing that was found was a piece of pottery. So who knows, could Maura have been in the concrete at one point? And then when this guy found out that people were tipping off Fred Murray and the police about, you know, the theory of a body being buried under that cement, could he have gone back in there and dug up whatever he buried under the cement and moved it and then re-cemented the area? I guess that's possible. But who knows? Like, why else wouldn't this guy want his house investigated unless he had something to hide? Who knows? Maybe it was another body. Maybe he killed somebody and it wasn't Maura. We may never know. Then in 2021, at the base of Loon Mountain, which wasn't far from the accident scene, bone fragments were found. Unfortunately, they were not identified as belonging to Maura Murray. So from time and time again, the Murray family has been disappointed. They've had leads. They've followed the leads. They've been tipped off by some really messed up people. Trolls have really infiltrated this case. And each time it has led to a dead end. I would go into detail about some of these trolls. There's even one guy who went on YouTube and made a really creepy video, but it was found that he had no relation to the case. He was just being a complete dick. So not worth it. The unfortunate fact is that Maura Murray still remains missing. To this day, Maura's family still looks for her. Back in 2009, Maura's mom, Lori, died of cancer on May 4th, 2009, which was actually Maura's birthday. So it's extremely ironic, in my opinion. She died not knowing the whereabouts of her daughter, but I like to believe that when you pass on, you get the answers to whatever questions you have. So I like to believe that she knows exactly where Maura went and what happened on that cold night in February 2004. So what of Billy Roche? I can't find too much information. All that I know is that he was charged for sexual abuse allegations, and an ex-girlfriend claimed that she experienced years of abuse, physical and sexual, and even stalking by Billy. It has been said that multiple women have come forward about Billy Roche and his erratic, at times violent behavior. There was also a rumor of one woman coming forward stating that when she would have sex with Billy Roche, she would get aggressive and choke her and call her Maura. So again, that's a rumor. Speculation, but needless to say, the people closest to Maura do not believe that Billy had anything to do with her death. He did plead guilty to a misdemeanor in a sexual abuse incident, so obviously we know he's made some poor, bad decisions, and he reaped the consequences for that. So this brings us to the end of our episode today. If you would like to get more information about Maura and stay updated in her case, head over to mauramurraymissing.org. This website is controlled by her family and they post relevant information to her case. You can follow her sister Julie on Twitter at JulieMurray2-9. Julie is also over on TikTok where she keeps her sister's case alive. You can follow her by searching at Maura Murray Missing on TikTok. If you have any information or tips regarding Maura Murray's disappearance, please contact your local FBI office or the nearest American embassy or consulate. Otherwise, contact Maura's family directly by going again to that website, www.mauramurraymissing.org, where you could submit a tip under contact information. So that, my friends, is the case of Maura Murray. If you would like to discuss this further and talk about your theories or what you think happened to her, head over to Instagram at crimeghoul_ and feel free to DM me and we can have a conversation about it. Otherwise, check out the case photos from today on my Instagram or TikTok or Facebook. I will be posting them all there. And if you feel interested in hearing my short takes about some of the cases I cover, head over to TikTok and look up Crime Ghoul and you'll find me. If you are looking for a way to support the show so I could bring you even more true crime content, head over to my Linktree in my Instagram bio where you can find ways to do so. If you go and search me on Anchor Podcasts, there is a way to support the show. Otherwise, if you're looking for a free way to support the show, just share this episode on whatever social media you see fit. Maybe tag me, tag a friend. Otherwise, if you listen on Apple Podcasts, you could really help me out by leaving me a review and giving me a 5-star rating. Thank you so much for joining me on today's case. Join me next week where we'll be back with a brand new Notorious November themed episode. Until then, stay safe and always let people know where you're going, especially if you're going alone. Take care. I'll talk to you soon.